the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Tuesday, February 24th, 2015. As acclaimed filmmaker Laura Poitras wins an Oscar for her film Citizen 4, we'll hear directly from her about the film, Edward Snowden, NSA surveillance and more. And we'll examine the hypocrisy of a major legal decision to award more than $200 million from Palestinian institutions to U.S. victims in Israel. Plus, former U.S. Marine and State Department official Matthew Ho joins us to analyze the latest on the ISIS war. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Robert Jensen. He's an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Sonali.
Wisconsin lawmakers are taking up legislation to make it illegal for unions to have mandatory dues. As part of Governor Scott Walker's ongoing attacks on organized labor, the bill, if it becomes law, would effectively strip unions of political and economic power. There will be a public hearing in Madison today, but Walker has planned a fast track for the bill, and it could swiftly pass. Walker has promised to sign it as soon as it appears on his desk. Wisconsinites have planned protests against the bill, but Walker's sights are set on the White House, and he appears to see passage of the anti-union bill as cementing his presidential credentials with the Republican Party. 4 years ago, when Walker introduced a similarly anti-labor law, his actions sparked what is now called the Wisconsin Uprising. About half the states in the nation already have laws barring unions from collecting mandatory dues. These are euphemistically called right-to-work laws. Bob, Walker was in the news recently for claiming that President Obama doesn't love America, but it appears as though Walker doesn't love Wisconsin. What do you think?
Well, love, love, love. All you need is love, apparently. But of course, you also need law, policy, and power on your side. Scott Walker likes and loves part of Wisconsin, especially the business community and the more wealthy. The question is, do right-to-work laws do anything more than equate to the right to work at the lowest possible wage? I mean, imagine going up against Walmart as an individual. You have no power. You go up against Walmart as part of a union, you have bargaining power. This is as old as capitalism. So right-to-work laws have long been a fetish of the right wing to try and bust what little power unions have. Remember, unions are declining in power down to about 1 in 10 Americans belong. This may be the start of a final attack on unions, and that's why it's so important to defend them.
And a 19-year-old college student at the University of Illinois in Chicago stands accused of raping a fellow student. Mr. Mohammed Hussein told school authorities that he knew he had done something wrong and that he was apparently trying to reenact scenes from the best-selling book 50 Shades of Grey and the film based on the book, which is currently in theaters. 50 Shades of Grey, which has been very popular among younger readers and viewers, has been widely criticized for glorifying male dominance, domestic abuse, and rape. Meanwhile, two former football players at Vanderbilt University who were recently convicted of raping and assaulting an unconscious female student are awaiting sentencing. The sentencing hearing for Brandon Vandenberg and Corey Beatty has been postponed to April. The two young men could face decades behind bars. Well, Bob, there's clearly an epidemic of campus rape, but it now appears as though this popular new book and film could inspire a whole new level of sexual assault?
Well, we have to be careful about making causal claims, that is, connecting any media product, pop culture item, to behavior. The way I would say it is, you know, I doubt that 50 Shades of Grey made this young man do it, but 50 Shades of Grey is part of a culture in which young men routinely do it, that is, that sexual violence becomes almost normalized. So 50 Shades of Grey is simply one step in the pornographic culture. We don't have to make overly deterministic claims to recognize the nature of the problem. It's patriarchy. It's the way that patriarchy, male dominance, institutionalized male dominance shapes not only the way young men think about themselves, but as we see in this film, the way women think about themselves, the way the whole culture thinks about sex.
And finally, thousands of undocumented immigrants at a detention facility in Raymondville, Texas, are being transferred days after a riot left the center unusable. About 3,000 immigrants being held at the detention facility, nicknamed RITMO, for its resemblance to conditions at the notorious U.S.-run prison in Guantanamo, rioted on Friday. The Willacy County Correctional Center is a privately run prison whose rampant human rights abuses and appalling living conditions have been well documented by the ACLU and other groups. Prisoners are housed in large tents where they're exposed to weather conditions, insects, and constant sewage problems. The Friday riot was specifically aimed at the lack of medical care. It's the third time that a privately run prison housing immigrants has faced an uprising. Well, Bob, given these horrific conditions, is it any wonder that people rioted?
It almost makes you wonder how any decent person could live in the state of Texas. Oh, wait, I do. This is appalling, shameful. It's hard to find the right words. What this reveals is that the moral claims we make as a culture, that we respect all life, that we treat people with dignity, are shallow claims at best. And the private prison system, the way we treat immigrants, is a good indication of this. This particular facility is one, of course, many, all of which have problems, these problems most appalling, perhaps. But it reminds us that immigrants are people, and if we claim to be the moral beings we want to be, these kinds of conditions are simply unacceptable. It calls into question, of course, bigger issues around immigration, but this is a good place to start.
Bob Jensen, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sanal.
Robert Jensen is our daily Newsflash guest expert. He's an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The documentary telling the history-making story of how the National Security Agency spies on us all won the Best Documentary Award on Sunday at the Oscars. Filmmaker Laura Poitras was recognized with the industry's highest honor for her film Citizen 4, which eerily documents the meeting that she and journalist Glenn Greenwald first had with the infamous whistleblower Edward Snowden, was wanted in the U.S. on espionage charges. Laura Poitras is the founding editor of The Intercept alongside award-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald. She herself has been on a watch list since the making of her films My Country, My Country, which was nominated for Best Documentary in 2006, and The Oath. Both of those films were about the U.S. war in Iraq and the broader global war on terror. So it's only fitting that her third post-9/11 film about whistleblower Edward Snowden, entitled Citizen 4, focuses on the invisible war of mass surveillance against ordinary people. The film, which has been in theater since October, tells in intimate detail the story of how Poitras and Greenwald first met Snowden in a Hong Kong hotel room just over a couple of years ago, and I spoke with her in October about Citizen 4. Here is an excerpt of that interview. Welcome to Uprising, Laura Poitras.
It's great to be here again.
Yes, I should say welcome back. We had you on Uprising to talk about your first two films, My Country, My Country, and The Oath, of which this latest film, Citizen 4, is a sort of part three. I want to start by asking you that before Edward Snowden reached out to you, did you know this was going to be a trilogy? Did you have that in mind, that third war was really a war against all of us here in the U.S. and really, of course, a wider war on everyone's privacy the world over?
You know, the first film that I made in this trilogy, which is about the Iraq War, called My Country, My Country, I didn't conceive of this as a trilogy or as a long project. I kind of thought it was, you know, something I wanted to record. I wanted to document what was happening and the occupation. But I sort of thought the country would move and it would sort of recalibrate and move in a different direction. And then when I was editing you know, Guantanamo was still open, and then I said, you know, I really wanted to focus that on that and the next piece, and that's when it kind of became clear that this was going to be a series of films that focused on trying to understand the sort of post 9/11 era from sort of an on the ground human perspective. And so I started working on The Oath, and I thought, like, you know, the last part of it I really wanted to both bring home to the U.S. and then also to see like how the war on terror has played out here, and surveillance has been sort of one of the repercussions. So you have immediately after 9/11 the kind of domestic surveillance started, and particularly targeting of Muslim Americans. And even though, you know, this film doesn't focus on particularly, you know, targeting of Muslim Americans, it was kind of one of the sort of immediate responses. And so it kind of made a lot of sense to focus on surveillance as a topic.
So you knew you wanted to do a film on surveillance before Snowden reached out to you, or that sort of all happened at the same time?
Oh, yeah, well before. I mean, I was actually had been shooting for a while on the topic of surveillance and a changing, you know, media press landscape.
So did some of the footage in your film predate your Snowden reaching out to you?
Right, yeah. Ah. I started filming. Actually, the very first shoot I did on this film was I went down to Rio to meet and film with Glenn. And I didn't quite know what the story would be, but I was really intrigued by what he was doing, how he was doing journalism in a different kind of a way from sort of outside of the Beltway. And so I went down there and filmed the opening scene where you see him typing and they're surrounded by the dogs. And this was in the spring of 2011 when he was still reporting for Salon.com. And I just thought, like, he's doing something different. And I was interested in it. I was interested in what it meant for journalism. And I was interested in, you know, that there was something new kind of happening. And in retrospect, I realized that Edward Snowden had a similar response to the reporting that he was doing, because, you know, he had reached out to Glenn, as Glenn reports. He reached out to Glenn before he contacted me.
When Snowden reached out to you, when you made plans to go to Hong Kong, did you know that this would be part of your film, or were you just sort of going with an open mind to try to figure out if this guy was for real?
Yeah, I knew pretty early on that the correspondence I was receiving would be part of some project. But as in most of my work, I film them as sort of events are unfolding, and I don't really know sort of the future or what they're, you know, because things have not been decided yet. And so when I was first started receiving these anonymous emails, my gut instinct pretty early was that this was probably legitimate. And then my second feeling was that it's quite dangerous, and it was quite dangerous for the source that I was communicating with, and then also it was going to be dangerous reporting, you know, but that we were going to anger some really powerful people. And that would have been probably, you know, by February 2013 when I received a very detailed email that outlined some programs. And so, but at that stage, I actually thought that the person I was talking to would remain anonymous.
Right. Because, even from you, perhaps.
Yeah, of course,
right.
Even from me. So I didn't know who they were, and that at some point I would receive evidence and documents that supported the allegations that he was describing to me in these emails. So that's actually, I thought I was, you know, that I had some extraordinary emails from someone who I'd never meet.
Which wouldn't make a very interesting film.
Well, actually, I'm not quite sure. I mean, both my experience of receiving the letters was quite extraordinary. I mean, they were really powerful, and it was very clear that this person was taking huge risks, and what he was outlining was of like an enormous magnitude. So, I mean, the film I made in Guantanamo, one of the protagonists that I follow, which is Salim Hamdan, is a prisoner at Guantanamo, and he's actually never in the film. So I actually think that there are lots of ways, tools that you can use to tell narratives. So I just thought, you know, we'll see where it goes. But when in April, I received an email where he outlined the fact that he didn't intend to remain anonymous, and that when the documents would be released, he would claim his responsibility for releasing them. And when he told me that, that's when I said, okay, well, if that's the case, then you and I need to meet, and I want to bring my camera. And his response was, no, I don't want to be the story, and that he felt that the issue should be the story, and that I responded, you know, actually, you know, people will talk about you, and it's important for me to know and for the world to know your motivation for doing this. And, you know, we had a bit of a back and forth, and he also expressed concern that if we were actually in the same place, that there was a risk that if the government tried to shut us down, that the reporting couldn't move forward, right? So he didn't want to have been in a position where he's taken the risk to release information and that there was a possibility that it couldn't be reported on. So I provided assurances that that wouldn't happen, that if, you know, if we were raided or something, that there would be backups. And then he agreed. But it was absolutely his decision to always come forward. But I pushed for face-to-face. Hmm.
So the scenes that you filmed are very intimate in this hotel room. You can tell it's a confined space. But when you first met Snowden, were you surprised at how, for one thing, how young he was, and also just how earnest he was?
Yeah. I mean, so the way things unfolded, so I started receiving these emails, and in February, he urged me to say, this is going to involve, this reporting will require more people. And then that's what he recommended. I involve Glenn, and Glenn and I had this meeting in April where I told him I'd been in touch with a source claiming to have documents that he was going to release about the NSA. And Glenn was immediately like, yes, I want to be involved in that. And so when we arrived in Hong Kong, we expected to meet somebody much older. And so that was our first sort of disorienting, trying to okay, this is not what we expected, given the sensitivity of some of the documents. But then it actually made sense, you know, because I think, you know, what you see, I think what I think comes across is that, you know, what motivates him is a sense of, I mean, that he's somebody who grew up very much of the internet and believed in the sort of the internet and its human potential for, you know, for communication and for to empower people, and that it was just such an amazing, you know, human invention, and then he became, you know, sort of entering into the NSA and seeing how it's being used as a tool for, you know, monitoring populations. And
the tension rises when the stories start being published, and when he finally reveals himself, and when his girlfriend is paid a visit by the NSA, and we see that tension. And it's interesting how much you are able to tell on film that doesn't just come across in words. And did you sort of capture as many moments as you could and then decide which ones to play, or were you just in the right place at the right time with your camera?
Yeah, I mean, so all, you know, the type of filmmaking I do is sort of cinema verite, direct cinema, where mm-hmm. like I try to be in a moment at a place where actually things are happening in real time, and to try to understand those sort of moments. And so that's what I've done in all my work. Yeah. And so, but this was, I have to say, a unique, extraordinary opportunity, because, you know, to be in this place where we knew this reporting, you know, to be able to document this journalism as it was happening was, you know, sort of unprecedented in terms of being at a moment where there was something that would have reverberations beyond the sort of, you know, this small intimate gathering. And so I knew that. So it was clear from everyone, you know, Glenn knew that I was coming with a camera, and of course Snowden knew that, and Ewan. And so I felt like my job in sort of, well, I was in the hotel room was to document it. And as sort of events unfolded, and in terms of how we approached the editing, my editor and I, Mathilde Bonfoy, who's very, you know, without whom I couldn't have made this film, we made a decision early on that we were going to remain true to the chronology of what happened. So on the first day of meeting, we would only choose from that footage, and the second day, so that we would see this progression of tension and not crosscut. And so you see how that, you know, Glenn publishes the first story on Verizon, and then you know, the NSA knocks on his door in Hawaii and says, you know, where is he? And we could feel that that in the moment, as that you could feel like the personal sacrifice, and the fact that he was not only making personal sacrifices, but that other people were going to be impacted by his decision.
The other whistleblower that you profile in the film, obviously to not as much detail, someone who is able to live here in the U.S. is William Binney. We've had him on our program as well, and he maybe fits the more conventional stereotype, if you will, of the older, you know, career staffer turned whistleblower. And so you had a lot of this footage from outside that hotel room in Hong Kong that told the other dimensions of the stories that showed the other meetings, including Glenn speaking to a room full of reporters in Brazil. Was that the intention to show that there are many pieces to this story of which Edward Snowden was a crucial part, but still one crucial part?
Yeah, I mean, I think our intention that, I mean, we knew, I think, going into the editing that we had something that this, what happened in this hotel room in Hong Kong was kind of the heart of the film, and that we were going to, that what, how we built to that and sort of, and the repercussions that fall out would sort of be structured around that. And so what we wanted to do in the first act was to introduce sort of the context before we arrive in Hong Kong. So they include letters that I receive from Snowden before, you know, the sort of initial contacts and sort of, you know, put things in motion. And then we also introduce William Binney, who, you know, he represents the sort of what happens to the whistleblowers who do it, you know, within the system. And in his case, you know, it when I learned his story, which was from a New Yorker article that Jane Mayer did, I mean, I was really shocked. I mean, I was really shocked that a man who was entrusted to protect us from nuclear war against the Soviet Union. I mean, he really had a phone that they called him to say, what's going on, you know, that we trusted him to that level and that he worked for, you know, over three decades inside of the NSA, that the government would, in 2007, show up at his home with guns drawn. You know, I mean, to me, that was shocking. I mean, I thought I couldn't be shocked. You know, there's certain things you think like, well, I'm not going to be shocked. But that really did shock me that he and the other sort of what are referred to as the NSA 4, which include Thomas Drake, that the government came down so hard on them. And it became, you know, what I want to say in the film is that there is this sort of concerted crackdown on people who are exposing government illegality. So they're, you know, the journalists that expose it and the whistleblowers that expose what are illegal activities of the government, the government's response is to try to punish them and target them. And I think we've seen this, you know, this sort of, it's a trend that we're seeing in the post 9/11 era. And, you know, I mean, another example is James Risen, you know, the government right. coming down so hard on him and trying to get him to, you know, reveal his sources. I mean, there is this, you know, war on whistleblowers and war on journalists to try to find out, you know, who are the ones that are leaking this, you know, what are the secrets? And so anyway, we wanted to, in the film, provide the context. And so, you know, Binney sort of represents somebody who tried to blow the whistle internally on NSA domestic surveillance and the repercussions that happened to him, which I think inform the choices that Snowden makes when he chose to leave the country and seek political asylum. I mean, he knew very well what happened to Tom Drake and what happened to William Binney.
And you yourself have become sort of caught to an extent in this dragnet, finding that you've been on some kind of a watch list, likely for the films that you made, likely for the probing that you've done into the Iraq War, Guantanamo, Yemen, etc. How much of that, and you talk about that in the film too. And so as a journalist and a filmmaker yourself, you find, and that's an interesting position to be in because you're making a film about a topic that also personally impacts you. But I guess we find that all of this impacts all of us, even though we may not all have been on a watch list. We are all being watched, right?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, there are a number of things that are different. I mean, this film, like, at some, like, this film, in a way, you know, the history is kind of, I've become sort of like I began documenting the post 9/11 era, and then I sort of actually became a target in it, you know, through the work that I did. But I think in terms of how I was put on a watch list or why, I think it's important, like things I think it is and things I think it's not. I don't think there's some sort of thought police that are going around looking at films and saying, oh, we don't like those films. I mean, I really don't think it's the fact that I made a film about the, you know, the content of the film. I do think that there's been this sort of vast growth in the intelligence community, and that one of the things that they've done is they've created a secret watch list, and people get nominated. I mean, that's the language they use. You get nominated, and you're put on it. And what I think is disturbing about it is that there is absolutely no due process in it. Like, that you're put on this list and you're never told why and you're never asked a question. And it comes with, you know, these consequences. So in my case, I, you know, for 6 years was detained and searched and interrogated every time I crossed the U.S. border and had computers confiscated and reporters' notebooks, you know, photocopied. And which is, you know, it's a and there's no way to challenge it. You know, even when I filed FOIAs to find out what, you know, what was going on, the government's response was, well, we won't even confirm or deny the existence of a watch list, let alone why you might be on it. And so it is this kind of Kafka-esque maze that somehow I got pulled into. And I think it informed this film in many ways. In a certain way, the fact that I was put on a watch list made me more careful about source protection and start to use encryption and how to protect my, you know, material crossing the border, which made me more sophisticated so that when, you know, Snowden did reach out to me, I actually knew how to use encryption and sort of protect the material. So in a way, it's kind of as a repercussion of being sort of put in this watch list system that I had to learn new skills that actually were necessary to do the reporting that I did. At the heart, the film is, yes, it's about the dangers and scope of NSA surveillance and the threat that it poses to democracies. I mean, that's certainly a theme that I want people to come away from watching the film, but it's also very much a film about people, like individuals who take, you know, personal sacrifice and for some sort of what they perceive to be as a greater good. And so it really is a film about individuals and not just Snowden, but also William Binney. And I think, you know, Glenn's reporting has been, you know, really that the impact that the story has had wouldn't be possible without, you know, Glenn really taking on people, you know, head on and fighting for the importance of these issues and not backing down.
Laura Poitras just won the Best Documentary Award for her film Citizen Four, and you've been listening to an excerpt of an interview that I did with her in October. She was also nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary for My Country, her earlier film, as well as she also won two Emmys for The Oath. Her journalism on NSA surveillance received a George Polk Award for National Security Reporting, the Henry Nannen Prize for Services to Press Freedom, and contributed to the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, awarded to The Guardian and Washington Post. She's also the recipient of a 2012 MacArthur Fellowship, and she currently lives in Berlin. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now subscribe for direct access to all our shows online at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. A federal jury in Manhattan yesterday awarded the families of dozens of people $218 million in damages in a first-of-its-kind terrorism case. The Palestinian Authority and the Palestine Liberation Organization were held liable for supporting the actions of several attacks between the years 2002 and 2004 in Israel, which harmed or killed U.S. citizens. While the PA and PLO have long maintained that U.S. courts have no jurisdiction over them, the case went ahead anyway. The trial lasted 7 weeks and featured emotional testimony from survivors and victims' relatives in six attacks that left nearly 36 people dead and hundreds injured. Among the incidents was a 2002 bombing of a cafe at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, in which 9 people were killed, among them 5 U.S. students. Because the case was brought under a special terrorism law, the damages are automatically tripled to $655 million. In recent months, the Palestinian Authority has been crippled by Israel withholding tax revenues owed to it in retaliation against a PA bid for statehood at the United Nations. My guest is Charlotte Silver. She is an independent journalist who writes for Electronic Intifada and Al Jazeera English, and she's been following this case. Welcome to Uprising, Charlotte.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Now, what sort of precedence does this case set, and how can a U.S. court even collect damages from international entities?
Well, this isn't the first time that a U.S. court has determined that the PA could be held responsible for what appears to be other individual acts of violence or terrorism, as it's being called in this context. But it is the first time that a jury has awarded damages on the basis of this liability. And the evidence in the case what the case was supposed to prove was that the Palestinian Authority and the PLO had specifically planned and executed the 6 attacks at the core of the case that had killed the 33 people and injured hundreds more. But what it did more so was sort of prove a relationship that the PA had set up, sort of a system of awards to men and fighters who participated in the bombings and shootings. And it was much more vague than actually proving a direct connection to the specific acts. So the precedent that it could potentially set is that any so-called terrorist acts that occurred while the PA was in control during the Second Intifada could be traced back to the PA, which could potentially open up more civil litigation against the Palestinian political bodies. In terms of collecting the money, it's unclear. A lot of these civil litigations, they don't actually end up getting the money that is awarded to them based for various reasons. It's to be determined how this U.S. court will set up sort of a claims tribunal or other ways to collect the money. But the PA is appealing the case, and so the damages won't be awarded until that process is completed.
A few months ago, there was also a federal case in Brooklyn where a jury found Arab Bank PLC also liable, supposedly linked to acts of terror in Israel. I mean, why are these events in Israel being tried in U.S. courts? Doesn't the Israeli authority have enough power over Palestinian citizens and institutions to try to hold them accountable? And of course, they do hold them to these incredibly high standards. You know, we could have a whole nother discussion about the relationship between Israel and Palestinians. But why is it being tried in U.S. courts? Is it simply the citizenship of the victims in question?
Well, the U.S. has the Anti-Terrorism Act, which was passed in the mid-90s and allows U.S. citizens to sue for damages in U.S. courts. And the law was sort of set up as supposedly to deter international acts of terrorism. And what it has sort of allowed for is a very political process to play out in U.S. courts, and the appropriateness of a jury of 12 Americans presiding over what is essentially foreign affairs is up to a lot of question. But for this case, for example, the plaintiffs are American citizens, but it was initiated by an Israeli law group called Israel's Law Center, or Shurat Hadin, which works under the motto of bankrupting terror one lawsuit at a time. But really, you know, the amount that they have actually extracted from the entities they've sued is very small, and really these lawsuits are sort of means for political lawfare.
Lawfare. Wow, that's an interesting term. Now, let's talk about the hypocrisy here. Just days ago, Israel's Supreme Court exempted the Israeli Defense Ministry from liability for actions by its forces that it deemed to be wartime activity, quote unquote, in the case of the 2003 killing of Rachel Corrie. She was a U.S. citizen. She was killed by an Israeli bulldozer in Rafah, and that case was also brought forward in a U.S. court, but was dismissed. So somehow her killing is not an act of terror, but these others are?
Right. And really, you know, the prosecution and litigation against terrorism is as political as the term is itself. And what a court deems as terrorism or an act of terrorism that it can intervene in is entirely a political decision. In the case of Rachel Corrie, the courts dismissed the suit that the family tried to bring against Caterpillar, the multinational corporation that creates the bulldozers that killed Rachel Corrie in 2003. The court dismissed the lawsuit because on the grounds that it would be intruding in the political branch of foreign affairs. And that is the sort of basis for all courts not usually not presiding and not adjudicating in cases against states. Most states are immune from U.S. courts, and the PA and the PLO don't enjoy that immunity because the U.S. does not recognize it as a state, as is well known, even though the United Nations General Assembly does recognize it as a state. Over 130 countries recognize it as a state. The U.S. doesn't, and so it doesn't enjoy that immunity that it tried to argue it should have. Exactly. The hypocrisy and the double standards that are sort of on display here, one for the Palestinian Authority and another for Israel, is very clear.
There's also the case more recently of Tariq Abu Qadir, the U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent who was beaten severely by Israeli soldiers for doing basically nothing. He was finally cleared of all the charges. He was jailed as well. Young, 15-year-old boy, I believe. There is apparently one officer facing charges, but I'm wondering, there's the Israel's brutal actions in Gaza, any crackdowns in the West Bank, and I'm not sure if any U.S. citizens have been killed or maimed in those attacks. But I'm wondering if this jury award that happened yesterday sets any kind of precedent for the families of U.S. citizens that might have been attacked by Israel to take Israel to court under the same terrorism pretext. Or, again, is it just that terrorism only applies when the perpetrators are Muslim or Arab and the victims are non-Muslim or non-Arab?
Well, it does seem to fall along those fault lines. Again, Israel and the U.S. and the Center for Constitutional Rights actually tried to hold Israel responsible for a bomb that dropped in 2002 on a Palestinian family in the Gaza Strip. They sued Avi Dichter, who was the director of the Shin Bet, Israel's secret service, for helping to locate an apartment that was housing families, Palestinian families in Gaza, to drop a one-ton bomb on, and it ended up killing 15 people and injuring hundreds more. And that case was dismissed under the Foreign Service Sovereign Immunity Act, and the Bush administration even intervened to make sure that it was clear that that bombing was the act of the Israeli state. There could not be awarded any damages in the case because it belonged to the realm of the executive branch and the political realm, and the courts did not want to intervene in it. And so that would apply to most of these cases in which Palestinians are victims of state violence or state terrorism, if you want to call it. There is a more recent case attempting to utilize the Anti-Terrorism Act on behalf of Palestinians living in the West Bank. It's already been dismissed, but they're appealing it again. These Palestinians are suing U.S.-based charities for funneling money that they've raised in the U.S., tax-exempt donations in the U.S., funneling to very fringe settlements in the West Bank, settlements that have vowed to commit price tag policies on Palestinian land against Palestinian families, have shot, injured, vandalized Palestinian land. So they're trying to claim that this is a form of terrorism in the West Bank, and these U.S. companies, these U.S. charities are enabling it. Mm-hmm. And so it's already been dismissed once in the U.S. courts, as you were saying, sort of as reflective of this double standard, but we'll see how it goes in the appeals process.
Right, and of course there have been numerous attempts to link Muslim-based charities in the United States to terrorism funding, but somehow those same standards are rarely applied when there is any kind of a link where the victims, again, are Muslims. Let's talk about the fact that Israel is withholding revenues, tax revenues, from the Palestinian Authority as this case is playing out, and the Palestinian Authority now apparently owes 10 families upwards of $600 million. It is being with the tax revenues that Israel collects on behalf of the PA are being withheld from the PA to the tune of $100 million a month. And the PA is supposed to use this money to keep alive millions of impoverished communities and people. Even Secretary of State John Kerry said that he's worried the entire Palestinian Authority would collapse if there isn't an immediate injection of cash. I mean, it's obscene that this federal court is now claiming that the PA owes hundreds of millions of dollars in this situation, as if the lives, of course, of these millions of Palestinians are worth so much less.
Right. And, you know, it's important to point out that the U.S. and Israel has benefited from the Palestinian Authority maintaining a sort of calm, sure, so-called calm, and they've been very instrumental in quelling resistance in the West Bank, and the recent trove of documents unveiled by Al Jazeera recently once again confirms the PA's integral support of putting the Goldstone report from 2009 under the rug, brushing it away. PA is one of the U.S.'s and Israel's greatest allies in sort of maintaining the occupation and status quo. So this jury decision does, in a lot of ways, contradict U.S. foreign policy. And it is possible that the executive could intervene in the appeals process to support to support dismissing what the jury ruled, but in the past it has not intervened on behalf of the PA, so it doesn't seem like the U.S. will do so. But it's true that having the PA dole out over $600 million while it is many cities in the West Bank aren't being able to pay its electricity bill is obscene.
Well, Charlotte, what's the best place for us to read your writings and find out more about this case?
Well, you can read my work on the electronic intifada .net, or you could follow me on Twitter.
And that's electronicintifada.net, and Shar Silver is your Twitter handle, I believe. So
Shar E. Silver,
and that's on our screens for our TV viewers. Thank you so much, Charlotte, for joining
today. Thank you so much.
My guest, Charlotte Silver, is an independent journalist who writes for the Electronic Intifada as well as Al Jazeera English. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll get an update on the ISIS war with former U.S. Marine and State Department official Matthew Ho. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The Iranian ambassador's residence in Libya's capital, Tripoli, was attacked earlier this week by militant soldiers claiming allegiance to the Islamic State. The house was attacked by a rocket strike and came just 2 days after reports emerged that ISIS killed 40 people in a double suicide bombing in the eastern part of the country. And ISIS beheaded a number of Coptic Christians from Egypt around at the same time. The incidents now mark Libya as another prime site from which ISIS is operating, in addition to northern Iraq and Syria. Among the consequences of the growing instability in Libya is the mass exodus of thousands of Egyptian migrants. Nearly 15,000 Egyptians have reportedly crossed a shared border between Egypt and Libya back into their home country. Some people were even being airlifted out. Airstrikes by the Egyptian and Libyan governments have targeted ISIS positions in recent days. Meanwhile, newly confirmed Defense Secretary Ashton Carter held talks in Kuwait and Afghanistan yesterday with top-level officials about the ISIS war. His goal, according to an official speaking anonymously to AFP, was, quote, to better understand the challenge posed by the jihadists and the range of efforts aimed at defeating them. My guest is Matthew Ho, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy, former Director of the Afghanistan Study Group, also former U.S. Marine and State Department official who resigned in protest from his position in Afghanistan in 2009. Welcome to Uprising, Matthew.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Now, Libya had already been racked by violence and instability in the aftermath of the NATO intervention that ousted Colonel Gaddafi. And I'm wondering if you can trace a line between that and what we're seeing today with ISIS. Does the ISIS insurgency only sort of add an extra layer of instability to this broken country, or has it sort of emerged from the instability that the NATO intervention created?
Thanks for having me on, Sonali. And it's part and parcel to what we see throughout these conflicts. And really, if you study warfare, if you look back at the history of war, you see as the wars continue, as a cycle of violence or hate or revenge perpetuates, extremist groups grow in strength, extremist groups grow in adherence, extremist groups grow in allegiance. And so certainly it should be of no surprise that we now see this successful extremist group, the Islamic State, its successes in Iraq and Syria, being duplicated in other places like Libya, and also there are reports of its emergence in Afghanistan. But this certainly is the result of the destabilization wracked by the civil war in Libya. And the West has a lot to bear in terms of responsibility, as we chose rather to find a solution, find some way for peace. We chose rather to exasperate that violence. And this is the consequences of our military campaign in Libya.
So essentially, we're seeing these volatile places where institutional infrastructure has been damaged, where governments that have been backed and installed in some cases by the U.S. are weak. We're seeing ISIS thrive in these perfect storm conditions.
That's right. I mean, ISIS is a parasite, like its predecessor Al-Qaeda in Iraq, like other extremist groups. I mean, you can take your pick of which civil war you want to look at throughout the world. But as these wars escalate, as people are put in situations where ethnicities are pitted against each other, religions are pitted against each other, ethnic groups are pitted against each other, and then outside powers come in and take one side against the other. The way I describe it a lot of times to American audiences is, imagine if an outside power had come in on behalf of the Hatfields versus the McCoys. What would that have caused the McCoys to do? Would it have caused the McCoys to give up? No, absolutely not. They would have fought harder. They would have gone to more extreme measures, and they would have reached out to whoever would be willing to help them. And that's what we see in conflicts like in Libya, which divide down onto regional and tribal levels, that the groups that are at disadvantage or the groups that don't have support from the outside look to others. And in cases like that, a group like the Islamic State prospers because it can gain adherence, it can gain allegiance, it can gain supporters because it's coming from the outside with financial support, as well as with an ideology and a propaganda that suits many in the conflict who feels that they're being oppressed. And now the Islamic State fits that role of liberator as well.
And the web of regional alliances and conflicts is getting more and more complex. The Iranian ambassador's residence just bombed or attacked by a rocket in Libya. Iran, of course, is seen as an enemy. The Shia government of Iran seen as an enemy by ISIS. And as the U.S. is trying to warm ties with Iran, you have Israel opposing that because Israel sees Iran as a threat. I mean, it's all very, very bizarre. And it seems to be getting more and more complex, again, enabling a group like ISIS to thrive. Now, we're seeing the governments of Egypt and Libya, both strongly supported by the United States, joining into the war effort very actively, dropping bombs and airstrikes as well. And we're seeing because of ISIS's brutality, we're seeing greater support in the populations of these countries backing their governments, because there's a frustration that that ISIS is getting stronger. Does that also complicate things, that there seems to be a strain of popular support for Arab governments to join the fight in ISIS now?
It does, and it makes this situation very dangerous. And also, you know, it's not just the Arab nations, but, you know, recently in the last week or so, the Italians have made noises of sending an invasion. And the Italians, with their long, illustrious history of invasion of North Africa, you know, it's funny, right? Because history may not repeat itself, but it certainly does rhyme. but you do. I mean, you have these other powers, other groups coming into the conflict, and again that further exasperates it. That further either strengthens someone's hand or weakens it, and causes them either to fight harder because they think victory may now be near, or fight harder because they fear that extinction may be near, that surrender, that loss, that destruction may be at hand. So it is. It adding more to this is very similar to adding kerosene to a fire. More hands in this case make for a much more stirred pot. And unfortunately, it's the people of Libya who are suffering as these various outside powers intervene to try and either bolster one side against the other, try and basically pick winners and losers, of which the United States has been continuously guilty of throughout the Middle East for decades now, or try and extrapolate their difficulties, their issues onto another country. Certainly, you could look at Egypt and say, as awful as the beheadings were, as also of the murder of those Egyptians were, you could also say that how much does the Egyptian Air Force bombing Libya take some of the internal pressure off of the Egyptian government in terms of protest against it?
Right, exactly. A lot of these Arab governments that are part of this coalition are able to distract from their own human rights abuses. We see the United Arab Emirates joining in, and of course, a number of these countries that the U.S. is quite happy and willing to have as part of its coalition having their own hands bloodied. What do you make of one of these, you know, it's sort of hard to tell what's real and what's not, what's propaganda from the U.S. press countering ISIS's own propaganda. ISIS tries to pump its own, you know, varied the sorts of things that they do in terms of their activities, and then you see some in the U.S. media repeat some bizarre sounding stories that are then kind of quietly ignored or never repeated again because it wasn't found to be true. So one new story that has emerged that seems to be true because, well, there's photographs, is that ISIS is training children at a training camp. Some apparently as young as 5. There are accompanying photos and a new video showing children being trained to become ISIS cubs. I don't want this to be real. I mean, what do you know about this?
There's no reason to doubt it. There's no reason to argue with the fact that the Islamic State is a brutal, horrible occurrence, that it is very terrible at every level. There's no reason why we should have this binary conversation, right, that one side is better than the other. There's no, but if you look at it in the same way, this notion of training children, I think most countries or many countries involved in these conflicts are involved in that to a certain level. Certainly, if you looked at the United States, we have junior ROTC programs at the middle school level. So children as young as 12 or 13 are taking part in organized, basically government-sponsored military training programs at that age. If you look at the violence that is rife throughout our culture, particularly in our media, I mean, look at how we view violence. PG-13 movies are more violent than R-rated movies.
Right. There was a study showing that we covered on our
absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely. So, and our priorities are so skewed. Our concerns or our values are so upside down. So it's okay for a 13-year-old or a child to see untold amounts of violence, literally hundreds of people being killed in a single film. But God forbid there's a woman's breast exposed. You know, I mean, and the same thing, too. If you watch a television show, if you watch the most popular drama shows, the TV characters kill somebody every episode. So this notion that violence is being foisted on young people within the Islamic State and they're being trained for it is, I have no doubt that's true, but we also have to be aware that we do the same things here. And the question should not be, the debate about these conflicts should not be who is worse, who is better, who has the moral high ground, because see, we certainly do not have the moral high ground. I mean, one thing I've been saying recently is this outrage at the Islamic State burning alive the Jordanian pilot is certainly justified. But for moral authority, we lack none because, as we know from the Senate's torture report, the U.S. government tortured people to death. So
they just didn't necessarily film it and spread it online. They just hid it.
And actually, what they did was they actually did film interrogations and torture sessions, but they destroyed the tapes because they were so damning and so incriminating.
Well, Matthew, I wanted to talk about the fact that there's right now a major battle shaping up in northern Iraq, where some of this first started, to retake the very strategic and important city of Mosul from ISIS. And if the U.S. succeeds, it's going to be seen as a major defeat for ISIS. The only other place that ISIS has had a major defeat so far has been at the Syrian border town of Kobani, where on the ground, Kurdish Peshmerga forces, very well trained, worked in coordination with airstrikes. And I'm wondering if there's a lesson there to be learned on how actually to at least militarily defeat ISIS, not even, of course, talking about the larger issue of U.S. hypocrisy and interference.
Yeah, well, I mean, defeating the Islamic State, you have to understand, too, is who are we trying to defeat here? Who's what are we trying to do? Are we trying to defeat the Sunnis? Because ultimately, that's what we're talking about. The Islamic State, ISIS, is gaining its power from Sunni populations of Syria and Iraq, who have been persecuted by the governments of Baghdad and Syria. And that's what these civil wars are ultimately about.
Right.
I would say besides them being stopped at Kobani, they have also been stopped within Iraq along the Kurdish border, particularly outside of the Kurdish oil fields, which used to be Iraqi oil fields, which the Sunnis used to have part of, but now they're completely controlled by the Kurds and protected by the American Air Force. And they have been stopped along the boundaries outside of Baghdad, which used to be mixed Sunni-Shia areas, but are now basically no man's lands. It's basically dead zones, cities have, right? So what you've seen, I think, is you've seen the Islamic State, ISIS, fill out the Sunni population, fill out, and they've kind of expanded as far as they can go.
Well, Matthew, we're almost out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have to have you back on to continue the conversation.
Absolutely.
Matthew Ho, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy, former director of the Afghanistan Study Group, former U.S. Marine, former State Department official who resigned in protest over the war in Afghanistan. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. And Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. Christian Beck is our production assistant. Federico Garcia, Kiana Turner, and Jonathan Alexander are our audio engineers. Camilo Ramirez is our sound editor. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.